If you like what you're hearing on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to sign up to receive one of our email security newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up now at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's holiday episode, there's a tough new data security standard on the block come January 1st, NIST's 800-171. We talk with an expert from the firm Bay Dynamics about what that standard will mean for the thousands of large and small firms who do business with the U.S. Department of Defense. Also, 42 countries around the world have approved new language for the Wassenaar Agreement, an international treaty that governs the trade in military weapons, including cyber weapons. We welcome one of the U.S.'s lead negotiators on that agreement, Katie Mazouras, back into the studio to talk about updated language in the Wassenaar Agreement on vulnerability disclosure and vulnerability research. But first, the firm UpGuard last week said that it found a data trove containing consumer profiles on 123 million American households in a weekly protected Amazon S3 storage bucket. The data, compiled by the data analytics firm Alteryx, includes a mix of U.S. Census data and consumer tracking information collected by the firm Experian. In all, billions of personally identifying details for almost every U.S. household were exposed, according to Chris Vickery, a researcher at UpGuard. In our first segment this week, we invited Chris into the Security Ledger studios to dig into the question of why so many sophisticated firms appear to be so clueless when it comes to protecting the sensitive data they collect. I started by asking Chris to talk about the Alteryx breach and what kind of data he found exposed there.
My name is Chris Vickery. I am the Director of Cyber Risk Research for UpGuard. This was another Amazon S3 file repository that wasn't Amazon's fault. It was a client of theirs that they've rented out storage space for. That the client, which we have every reason to believe is Alteryx, a software producer that allows you to look at large data sets. Alteryx offers the data that was involved here as part of a kind of bundled offering. On their website, they list it as having like a subscription cost of like $38,000 a year or something like that to get their platform plus this data and some other data. And so we believe it was, an employee of Alteryx or somebody Alteryx has contracted with that made the misconfiguration that made this file or this database, this listing, available for public download.
Yeah, and Alteryx appears to be a data analytics company, so they have tools for crunching huge amounts of data and analyzing it, let's say, for marketing or in sales purposes and understand your customers and potential customers. Is that correct?
That goes along with my current understanding, yes.
You said it was exposed on an Amazon S3. This is their hosted storage offering. This isn't the first breach like this that you've discovered. You had one a few months back for data that was at least licensed to or in the possession of contractors working, I think, for the Republican National Committee. Is that right?
That one had to do specifically with a company called Deep Root Analytics.
Yeah.
Part of the data that was exposed there was coming from a branch of the RNC called Data Trust. Now, the RNC, I believe, has, tried to distance themselves from Data Trust, saying it's a completely separate entity or whatever. But the fact that one of the fields was RNC ID, and there's plenty of interplay between Data Trust and the RNC, in my personal opinion, there's not a whole lot of differentiation between the two. And yes, this Data Trust data that did then apparently flow down to Deep Root Analytics And then Deep Root was the party at fault for exposing it to the public.
And Deep Root, again, a data analysis firm more focused on political clientele and voters than on consumers, but obviously overlapping data sets here, right? Many consumers are also voters and vice versa.
That would make perfect sense. Yes, consumers are voters.
I've always wanted to ask you, because you've been so many of these that have the Chris Vickery stamp on them, so many of these huge discoveries in the last couple of years. How do you go looking for these? In this case, I think you found there was a subdomain out there that had the Alteryx name on it. Did you go looking for the subdomain, or are you just really crawling Amazon and Azure and the other cloud infrastructures out there looking for interesting information, interesting data?
Yeah, I've got about between 6 and 12 different techniques, I guess you could call it, for finding this publicly exposed collections of data. They're all not really necessarily related, but I'm really surprised that there aren't more people pointing this stuff out. I guess it comes down to people being afraid of being sued or being accused of hacking or something or other. There's a lot of stuff that kind of keeps the lid on the huge can of worms that is data breaches and leaks and stuff. It's a lot bigger than people tend to realize, of epidemic proportions, and is really feeding, I think, probably a lot of malicious behavior. And we should be more willing to talk about it and bring it up and realize that it's a pervasive problem.
Yeah. And you talk about some of the information that's in this, that was in this Alteryx data trove. But maybe tell our listeners what types of information was in this huge data set. And again, it was 123 million rows in this database, each corresponding to a U.S. household. What types of information about each household was there?
Yeah, there were, like you said, 123 million rows. There were 248 columns for each row. Not every row is filled in 100%, but, you know, a decent amount is. Things such as address, phone number, what types of magazines are subscribed to at that household, what company or bank or organization owns the mortgage on the house, things like median income, likely household income, ethnicity, number of children, the ages of the children, all sorts of details that people would consider pretty personal and not wanting to just hand out to the general public. Some of the most concerning aspects to me are the ones that can be used in knowledge-based authentication, where you go for a student loan, or you want to buy a car, or you want to, you know, do something that has to do with a pretty heavy-handed financial agreement. And so whoever you're interacting with, the company wants to verify who you are, not only by using your Social Security number, which Social Security numbers were not specifically in this data breach. I want to make that clear. But when you sign up for certain authentication levels, they want to know your Social Security number, your name, your phone number, your address, all this stuff. And then they'll ask knowledge-based authentication questions like, what company or bank owns the mortgage to your house? The questions of that nature. And that type of thing is what's in here.
Yeah, these are the kind of challenge response questions, addresses you used to live at, or banks that you have accounts at, or amounts of your mortgage and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So very useful for defeating those types of knowledge-based authentication systems. Obviously useful for identity theft, potentially, right?
Oh, clearly, yes. Yeah. So the more a bad guy can learn about a target, the more they're able to do and convince people of. And
right.
Social engineering is such a powerful thing. Knowing little bits and pieces about people can really bring it all together and give you a big picture.
Now, to clarify, the data wasn't just publicly available. In other words, you couldn't just download or view the data without first logging into this Amazon S3 storage container. But as you point out, that is not a very high hurdle to get over. Talk about what kind of protections were around this data.
The problem that was present was that whoever controlled this bucket ultimately, whatever individual or whatever, had turned on a setting that I refer to as global authenticated users. I don't know why this setting exists in the Amazon Web Services cloud, but it allows anyone with an Amazon account to access the data, to download a copy of the data, see that it's there. And Amazon Web Services account are free and open to the public, so anybody can have one. And if you turn on this global authenticated user setting, anybody can access the data. Can you think of a reason why that setting would exist? I personally cannot.
How often do you find data troves like this on Amazon Web Services hosted servers or Amazon S3 hosted storage containers? You're doing this all the time. Is it very common to find data that's at least as exposed as this Altiris data?
It is very common. Again, I want to emphasize it's not necessarily Amazon's fault. It's, these buckets, these containers are secure by default. You have to actively go in and change the settings in order to expose them publicly. Why people are doing this, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But it happens all the dang time. And if I were to sit down with you, I could show you immediately, you could give me a keyword and I could show you immediate examples of companies that have created buckets with that keyword in the name somewhere that are exposed to the public.
Is it usually this global authenticated user feature that's tripping them up, or are there other configuration settings that are tripping up organizations on these platforms, these cloud platforms?
It's more common that they've just turned on absolute public access, like absolute everybody. It's just straight up public access. When there's an exposure, that's usually the case.
Is Amazon at fault in your mind at not putting up more warnings or better information? I started my career as a technical writer, and so there's always part of me that assumes that you could solve this problem with better documentation, the sort of RTFM approach to life. Is that part of the problem, though? I mean, is there some culpability for Amazon there?
I have found exposures on so many different platforms, starting with MongoDBs and moving to rsync and finding S3 buckets. It was even a pervasive problem with even before all this stuff with anonymous FTPs and other ways of holding data. I think there's just a fundamental problem with human beings, and that a certain percentage of people, if you allow them to make data public, a certain percentage of people are going to do that regardless of how sensitive the data is. So I'm not convinced either way that Amazon could do it better or, could not do it better. I think just humans are flawed and we need to rail it into people. Just keep hammering away. Don't do this. Don't expose sensitive data.
Okay. You sounded a little bit like Agent Smith there from The Matrix, but I'll let that go. There's a problem with humans. Okay, so if humans are to blame, and these cloud platforms obviously make it really easy to just click buttons and kind of manifest or create storage servers and actual functional web servers and application servers. I mean, it's all very fluid and easy. I'm guessing that might be part of it as well, is just how easy it is to deploy these assets. So what is the fix? How do you impose some sanity around this so that companies are not accidentally exposing sensitive personal information to the public?
Well, now we're coming full circle to the whole reason I currently exist in my current position. There is a growing market for companies like the one that I work for, UpGuard, that make platforms that allow you to double check this stuff and allow you to put checks in place that will alert you if a container or a repository or a server or a service that one of your developers is running, if it gets switched to public accessibility. A platform like the one that UpGuard offers allows you to be notified of that kind of thing. So if we can't just fix basic humans, perhaps allowing the humans that are in control to open their eyes and better understand what's plugged in and better understand how it's configured will decrease the amount of these catastrophic breaches that we see.
I mean, the other piece of this would seem to be that there does need to be more scrutiny of some of these data analytics firms and data brokers who are accumulating huge amounts of data. I mean, obviously, this incident involved Experian. We saw a huge breach affecting Equifax. Is there any fix there? And also in pursuing this incident, I know you reached out to Alteryx. What response did you get from the company about this?
At first, when I reached out to Alteryx, and I had a very hard time, I went to their website, I had a hard time finding any sort of email address to notify them.
Yeah, I did also. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess they are afraid of receiving spam or phishing emails or something like that. So they don't list a lot of contact info, but they do list the phone numbers of their various offices. So I called their main office, and the young woman that answered the phone was unable or unwilling to give me an email address to report it to, which to me seems like a problem right there. You should definitely have something set up for reported data breaches.
Kind of a new twist on security through obscurity, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Just don't let anybody report anything, right?
No. We cannot hear you.
So she suggested that I create an account on their support portal and file a complaint, or I guess she was trying to call it a ticket, or she was calling it a complaint. I guess she was trying to refer to a ticket. But I am unwilling to agree to an end user license agreement or a terms of service document like they probably require to create an account just to tell them that they're exposing data. That seems unreasonable to me. So I proceeded to leave my contact information with her, and I sent a message via LinkedIn to two of their executives, basically notifying them of the data exposure in a form message that has been approved by my legal staff here at UpGuard. I didn't hear anything back, and then I was eventually able to hunt down the phone number to Alteryx's general counsel, and I left a voicemail, and he called me back, and he understood the situation. That was a few days later, and he was able to get the ball rolling on remediation and, you know, just getting things fixed.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
That's somewhat shocking that it took you those lengths of kind of trolling LinkedIn and actually reaching out to the company's lawyers to get a response from them, especially, again, given the amount and the sensitivity of the data that they're holding. At any point, was there any coordination with you or any effort to reach out and learn more about what you had discovered and understand it? Or was it just, you know, that particular S3 bucket you discovered was properly secured and that was how you knew that they had gotten the message?
Well, he and I had a pretty good conversation. I gave him a lot of upfront information, you know, in our initial conversation, and enough that they could figure out, you know, I gave him the exact address and everything and explained what I thought the problem was. And he was probably able to relay enough of that information to their team to, you know, pretty quickly get it shut down or secured. And then I checked the bucket a little bit later, you know, and it was inaccessible. So that, yeah, if I discover any more situations specific to Alteryx, at least I know who to contact.
Now, I mean, we know you're out there looking for this stuff, but you're a good guy, so I don't think, need to fear for Chris Vickery misusing this information or using it for nefarious purposes. Do we know if there are bad guys doing, is there a bizarro UpGuard that does all this, but with the idea of weaponizing that information?
I'm certain there are bad guys looking for this stuff. I mean, there's plenty of scripts out there that appear all the time for automating it and making things, you know, easier to discover this stuff. And I see enough discussion about it. And, you know, the fact that I wasn't the first one to ever find this, you know, issue, just it speaks volumes about how many people there must be out there looking for this stuff and just not saying anything when they find it.
Have you raised any of these issues with Amazon or any of the hosting companies?
Oh, this is definitely on their radar. You know, I've had discussions with Amazon's security team. They've reached out. They are very much aware of, you know, every finding that gets published.
And what's their response?
Well, some of it be comfortable sharing, but their overall message is, you know, Amazon's doing what it can and feels that is necessary to allow customers to secure their data properly. But there is a shared responsibility model. And Amazon, while they may be responsible for the physical security of these servers and providing the basic backbone, I guess, it's up to the clients to properly configure it. It's not open by default. If the clients are choosing to do this, there's very little Amazon in the end can do to stop somebody from shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, if somebody is legally purchasing a gun and putting bullets in it and aiming it at their own foot and pulling the trigger, there's very little the gun manufacturer can do to stop that.
Yeah, it does also speak to this question of third-party risk and where companies' responsibility begins and ends. And I mean, one of the points you made at the beginning of the talk was, you know, this wasn't Experian's fault. You know, it wasn't an Experian data breach. On the other hand, there was a database with 123 million rows in it of Experian data and 220 columns of Experian data that had been licensed to a third party and then more or less left exposed to the internet. It's like dropping your kid off at the daycare where they've got, you know, the broken window and the rusty swing set, you know, I mean.
Yeah, there's definitely an argument to be made that if Experian can legally collate and bring together all this data in such a concentrated form, then, you know, what further responsibilities could be imposed upon them to better secure it? I mean, if they're going to license it out and sell it, should they really be giving an unencrypted mass dump in 136 gigabyte file to a company? Or should they be tightly controlling, you know, one by one queries to an encrypted, authenticated database? You know, there's definitely an argument to be made there.
Yeah, there's something unseemly about it, right? Like, you pay us $38,000 and we just dump this 36 gigabyte unencrypted, you know, Excel spreadsheet on your Dropbox account or something. I mean, there's just something so, I don't know, kind of crude about it. Like, here's the data pill.
You know? I certainly understand that. Yes, definitely.
There's something just so ham-fisted about it all. I can't but think that 10 or 15 years from now, we'll look back and say, you know, this was kind of the Civil War battlefield surgery stage of the data analytic profession, right? Where they were just, you know, dropping huge wads of data all over the place.
And using bone saws to bite on the stick. Yeah,
and,
exactly. Take this swig of whiskey and bite down on my bandana.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of where we're at right now, but I don't know. One of the big things that's on the horizon for 2018, obviously, is a go-live date of the EU General Data Protection Rule, GDPR, in May. One of the issues that's come up in connection with that is this notion of the risk and the debt that you create by aggregating so much data, that companies have tended to look at data as only a benefit and no risk. You know, the more you have, the more you can mine and slice and dice, but not really considering the costs of storing it, protecting it, and so on. You know, the work you do really seems to get at that, except that few of these companies seem to suffer monetary penalties, at least now. I'm wondering if you think that GDPR might put teeth into some of what you're doing and really force companies to reckon with these issues.
My work, the interviews I give, the conferences I speak at, it's all very much the writing on the wall for these guys. They need to open their eyes, if they haven't already, and see that the public is not going to put up with data being exposed so cavalierly. It's going to come around and there's going to be a reckoning unless things start to change before then.
Okay, so we're almost at the new year. New Year's resolutions for some of these companies that are maybe wealthy in data but poor in common sense?
Well, they should realize that holding on to data is a liability. There is a risk that you run. And if you're holding on to things like, let's say, you know, 8 years ago you had a forum with a bunch of logins and other stuff, and now you're holding on to MD5 hashes of passwords for every one of your 2 million users, there's no benefit to your company of holding on to old password hashes of a defunct forum. There's nothing you can do to gain money out of that other than selling passwords, which is illegal. So purge that data. Get rid of it. You don't need to hold on to it any longer. It's just a risk. If you're one of these worried companies, get in touch with UpGuard. You know, I don't want to be too much of a shill, but that's, as you know, the last thing I would have to say is there are companies out there, UpGuard, our competitors, everybody, that are willing to offer, you know, at least the beginnings of solutions to this stuff. And it's a conversation that may not be the most comfortable, but you'll sleep better at night.
Chris Vickery of UpGuard, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It was great speaking to you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Up next, the toughest data security standards in the U.S. are set to take effect with the new year, and if you're a company that does business with the Pentagon, the new standards are aimed squarely at you and your business partners. In our second segment, we invited Thomas Jones, a senior systems engineer at the firm Bay Dynamics, to come in and talk about NIST's 800-171 standard, how it will improve federal data security, and what it will mean to the companies that do business with the U.S. military.
With us on the line is Thomas Jones. He's a senior systems engineer at the firm Bay Dynamics, and he's in the studio to talk with us about the 800-171 deadlines that are approaching. Thomas, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Good to have you. First of all, tell us just a little bit about what Bay Dynamics does.
So Bay Dynamics is a cyber risk analytics platform that allows you to identify insider threat, outsider threat, as well as do DLP optimization. So it's an analytic platform that kind of overlays your entire defense in depth environment and gives you meaningful, actionable data.
Tell us just a little bit about this 800-171 standard and kind of where it came from and what it's all about.
So the Defense Department actually implemented this back in December 30th, 2015. When they initially implemented it, they hadn't defined what controlled unclassified information was. And that's actually at the heart of the entire initiative. The idea is there's certain levels of information that doesn't rise to the level of secret or top secret or classified that still needs to be protected. And it's in the vital interests of the United States to see that it's protected. And a great deal of this information sits on contractors' infrastructure. So what the Department of Defense did is they've actually said, well, if you're going to do business with us, these are the standards by which you had to actually keep your IT environment or anything that will be touching controlled unclassified information. NIST developed the standard, the 800-171, which is a family of 14 security groups that comprises over 110 specific metrics that you had to go through and actually define, make sure you're in compliance with, and actually align your IT infrastructure with. And it ranges from everything from access control to awareness and training to policies and configuration to risk management. It's a very far-reaching standard.
I mean, we've seen a number of major breaches, you know, affecting federal data. Is this in some ways a response to that?
Oh, absolutely. And what they saw in things like the OMB breach, they saw a lot of PII, personal information, being compromised. Things that, like your social security number and your home address and your name and those things that other organizations are required to actually maintain in a secure fashion. And what a lot of these things have highlighted to us is while we have standards around the federal agencies and how they're actually supposed to be managing their system and the data within their system, a lot of the contractors don't have those same standards in place, and no one's holding them accountable for how they actually leverage or use or store or manage that information or the systems that house that information. This is a first step towards that, and it's coming out of the DOD. It correlates nicely with a lot of the things that are happening in the civilian side of the house, especially around homeland security and around risk management.
What are the teeth here? What do companies that do not bother to comply with this face in terms of retribution or consequences?
So that's one of the really fascinating things about this. A lot of times these NIST initiatives are put out there and they have very little bite to them. There's little to no consequences if you don't adhere to them. In this instance, however, if you do not actually comply with 800-171, you stand a very good chance of losing your contracts. You can be considered in breach of contract and the whole contract award can be handled it to somebody else. For a major system integrator like a Lockheed or a Deloitte or what have you, that can equate to millions and millions of dollars and thousands of jobs. There's a lot at stake here. One of the more interesting things about this, though, is it's not just the Lockheeds and the Deloittes and the Northrop Grummans that are actually looking at this. They had to be aware of how they fall in line with all 14 key security areas, but also how their subcontractors fall in line with it, too. Because they could lose those contracts based on the performance of their subcontractors. And that's where things get a little dicey.
Yeah, this is an issue that comes up a lot. Third-party risk is how we talk about it in the commercial sphere, in the private sphere. But obviously, you know, government has a huge third-party risk problem.
No, absolutely. You have people that are very talented from a technical standpoint, but they may be a one or two person shop. They don't have a group in place to help them actually adhere to these standards. And they also probably didn't build budget into their quotes when they're actually bidding on contracts to actually implement these. So they can find themselves in a bad way. And quite frankly, if there are only two or three people, they may not even be aware of these standards.
So there's this January 1 cutover date. Do we have any sense on how soon after that enforcement actions might happen? I mean, they've had a two-year runway here to get off the ground with 800-171. Is the expectation on the part of the DOD that everyone will have crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's by January 2nd?
Initially, it was looking that way, but there seems to have been a softening. And I'm not sure if it's coming out of the DOD. Or if it's slowly trickling out through the media and whatnot. But it looks as if the DOD is actually softening the requirements for what's supposed to be delivered on January 1st. What we're hearing now is they're looking for a report of how well somebody falls into compliance, but also those areas that they aren't in compliance with and how long it will take them to actually become compliant. The DOD doesn't want to actually have to rebid these contracts. It's an extremely expensive process, and they don't want to lose contractors that have been helpful or diligent in these contracts. But at the same time, they do need to make sure that these environments are secured. So what they're doing is they're giving the contractors a little bit more headway, and they're making them show them a plan for becoming compliant where they aren't. But I think it's changed in the last 2 to 3 months.
So if I can't give you my homework on January 1st, I will at least give you a letter telling you when I will be able to hand my homework.
Exactly.
It's better than nothing. These security requirements, again, as you said, there are 14 families of requirements. And then within each of those families, there are anywhere from, you know, two or three to dozens of separate requirements. And they cover areas like access control, auditing, configuration management, identity and authentication. Which of these are interesting to you and worth noting?
So the ones I find most interesting are the 11th one, which is the risk assessment. So it really comes down to knowing your environment, knowing the risk that every piece of data, every item in the environment poses to mission. I find that interesting because the entire federal government's starting to move towards a much broader risk management framework. You see it in other NIST publications like 800-139, 800-136, both of which focus on how to manage through risk, how to procure items based on the risk, how to justify procurement based on risk. And then the DOD's recently rolled out their entire risk management framework, which all of their subsystems are supposed to actually boil into, and all the agencies are supposed to have a risk scorecard available to them going forward. So they know where their greatest areas of risk lie. The other areas that are really interesting, and mostly because it focuses on what this special publication is all about, are the system and information integrity, and then the security assessments. Knowing where you lie in things, knowing where the information is that you're supposed to be protecting, knowing who's touching it, who's moving it, who has access to it, and what they can do with it when they find it. Those are, I think, the biggest areas I find interesting here. And really what the DOD is saying is to do business with us, you have to meet a minimum level of security, which, you know, from a person that's actually worked with the DOD, a person that's actually had my information housed by these groups, I'm glad they're actually applying some level of standard to it. I'm tired of people actually taking my information and having to always go back and buy LifeLock every time there's a major breach in the federal government. So for me personally, I'm very glad that they're actually raising the bar as far as they are. It's not terribly high. This shouldn't be that difficult. This should have been in place already in most of the major contractors.
One of the key problems here for companies large and small, again, there are 14 different families of requirements and then separate requirements under each of those families, is that all of this applies to their use and handling of this, you know, what's called CUI or Controlled Unclassified Information, basically federal data that they are in possession of as a result of their work with the federal government. So these requirements really apply to the systems that handle and manage that data, and I guess the employees who work with those systems, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so these companies need to, first of all, figure out what those systems are, which means they need to understand a little bit where this data is within their organization and how they work with it. You talk about data flows. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. My sense is that that's actually a pretty heavy lift for many companies, particularly large companies, to do that type of an audit.
Yes, and especially the siloed ones. So you look at the major SIs, and as a rule, they manage down to the contract. Given that every contract can be slightly different in how they manage their data, where they put data, and how they house it. So there's not a lot of uniformity across a lot of these organizations. So yeah, that's one of the parts that is such a heavy lift, because it does require so much touching across silos. And that's something that, especially in a DoD or a secure environment, it doesn't come easy. It's something we've all been taught to not do. You don't want to actually share communication or communicate outside your silo too often, because there's security risks associated with that. You know, the SI that's actually going to be successful here has to actually look at, you know, reaching down to each one of those individual contracts and contract groups and looking at how they're housing data there. And the ones that want to be successful consistently have to put a policy in place and a procedure in place around how they manage data, where they house data, how data is marked, how data is tagged, you know, how people are made aware of what is sensitive data, you know, and what isn't sensitive data, and what you can do with both. You're absolutely right. That's probably one of the heaviest lifts. The DoD gave them 6 months, or suggested they take six months just on that.
Yeah, which begets my next question. You've got your ear to the ground in this sector. What have you heard from companies that are going through this process, or what is your sense about how on top of this companies are, and what some of the snags have been along the way?
What I'm hearing is basically everybody's, you know, in line to actually deliver this. They started taking it seriously about 7-8 months ago, at least the larger to mid-size organizations. Most of them had a good part of this already done. So it was things like figuring out where the data lives and how the data is managed. That was really the heavy lift for a lot of them. I think most of the larger SIs believe they have this in hand. They've been pinging most of their subcontractors and making these requirements known to them for the last 2 to 3 months in most instances. I think there is a little bit of concern that there'll be a few last-minute surprises around subcontractors that are actually touching controlled unclassified information and hadn't previously been aware of it. So they're looking at those things, and they're digging into it fairly aggressively. At this point, the ones that are still scrambling to meet the deadlines are usually the ones that are really large, really well established in the DoD. So you're looking at your Lockheeds and your Northrops and your Raytheons, the ones that are truly have large infrastructures rolled out in multiple contracts.
A lot of this is going to come down to enforcement. Some of these requirements would seem to suggest that there are going to need to be audits both of their IT system as well as potentially their physical plant. Do we know that the DoD is intending to do those types of on-site audits?
So the DoD hasn't actually said they're going to do audits yet. It is something I think everybody's kind of expecting. Initially, they're saying this is based on self-reporting, and that if it's discovered that, you know, you were inaccurate in your reporting, you will certainly lose the contract. The other thing is if you purposely suggest that you're in compliance when you're not, and that can be shown, you're more than in breach of contract, you're actually breaking the law, and you'll find yourself in prison. So there is some initiative around making sure that you're very upfront and honest about where you stand with things. That said, this initial phase is, you know, based on self-reporting. The expectation is, well, it's twofold, that there will be audits going forward, and they'll be tied to new contracts and renewals of existing contracts.
Right.
And then the other part of this is we fully expect this to bleed over from the DoD side of the house over to the civilian side of the house. So contractors on major initiatives in the civilian sector will probably be asked to do very similar, if not the exact same thing.
You know, this has come up in conversations I've had, particularly regarding the EU General Data Protection Rule, GDPR, and, you know, we don't have anything equivalent to that in the US, but does this kind of start to lay the groundwork for something like a federal GDPR, at least within the federal space? You mentioned it kind of spilling over into the civilian part of the federal government. You know, do you see that happening?
Certainly within the federal space. And I would expect to see some of that roll out in the next 3 to 4 years. You are starting to see many of those parallel concepts expressed in the 800 dash within the special publications, especially the 800 subset of those special publications. So things like the cybersecurity framework and 800-139, 800-50, 52, 142, all of them are kind of geared towards these are minimum requirements. These are things that have to be done to protect systems, to protect individual data sets, and to protect the people in the environment. So they've been there for a while, many of these, but the federal government's starting to actually take them very seriously. Now, the question is, will this bleed out of the federal government and over to the private sector? And my guess is you're going to start seeing that wherever the private sector interacts with the public sector, there's going to be some level of requirements in terms of how you actually manage your data sets and how you manage your systems. It's the federal government seems to be using, in this instance, in the 800-171, they're using the carrot to get certain behaviors generated or get the private sector to actually behave in a certain way, mm-hmm. as opposed to the fines and the stick. They're actually saying, well, if you want to do business with us, if you want to have contracts with the DoD, this is the minimum requirement that you have to do. I think that's very likely going forward going to be the model, specifically in DoD, or at least initially in DoD. But it may become the model throughout. I would expect it to be the model throughout in the very near term.
So, you know, we are hearing a lot, and in fact, in another segment of this podcast, we're going to be speaking with Chris Vickery, who discovered a huge trove of data on an insecure Amazon cloud storage instance bucket, data from a data analytics firm. This document, 800-171, doesn't mention cloud a lot, but I can presume that both the federal government and many of its prime contractors are rapidly migrating their IT infrastructure and their data to cloud-based systems, whether that's on Amazon or Microsoft Azure or Google or their own private cloud. How does this impact 800-171 apply to that? And is that something that, in your mind, the federal government is on top of and looking to? Because obviously there's a lot of loose security practice around cloud space storage and cloud-based servers and cloud-based infrastructure in general.
Right. And that actually brings up a good conversation around FedRAMP, which I can't claim to be an expert on. But anytime in the – so if you divide the federal government into the DoD or the military side and include the intel community in that and the civilian side on the other side, civilians been pushing towards the cloud for 3-4 years now. And they've been doing it through not only publicly facing cloud providers, but also government cloud providers, ones that actually focus to and cater to the government. So there is the GovCloud out there that a lot of the agencies will use. And it is FedRAMP certified, which is a general certification of security that meets the bare minimum of the federal security standards. The DoD has their own cloud. They've been standing up. It's, I would say, somewhat slower adoption levels over there. Given the nature of the data they're looking at, I'm sure you can understand why, but they are using it. They understand the cost benefits associated with them. So there is a push towards, you know, where possible, actually embracing the cloud. They generally are private clouds or clouds specifically focused for either the Intel community, the DoD community, or what have you. But there are, you know, given standards around it. 800-171 doesn't touch on it per se, but it does actually touch on how you deal with the data that lives in it and the environment surrounding it. So encryption comes into play throughout 171. You know, what data needs to be encrypted, where it needs to be encrypted, how you actually handle it, not only in transit, but, you know, data at rest. And that would come in play in a cloud environment. So my guess is in most instances it would call for encryption in a cloud environment because it isn't fully secure, it isn't on site, it isn't locked out. And many of our contractors that are actually out there, you know, they leverage the cloud heavily. I think the vast majority of them that are doing DoD type work do use the private clouds available to the federal government, or at least the ones that are FedRAMP certified. You're not supposed to have any of this data on environments that don't have FedRAMP certification.
If there's someone out there, one of our listeners, who, you know, clicked on this link because they're like, oh, 800-171, like, I think I was supposed to do something about that. So what, where can they start? What can they do to kind of come up to speed on this and apply some of this to their own organization?
Well, there's so NIST publishes all the special publications online. I would actually go up there and take a look at it. The appendix section within the special publication, it's very strong. It does a very good mapping. I believe Appendix D actually maps everything to the 800-53 standard and as well as the 2700 standard of security controls. So if they have either of those in place, they can actually go in and see how well they actually match up against things based on what they already have in play. So that's probably a good place to start. And the other place to start, the place that usually isn't covered by 800-53 or the 2700 ISO security standards, are things like being aware of where the data is, what the data is, and, you know, setting things up to help you identify the data that would fall under this. Those are really the things that need, in most places that are scrambling to comply at the last minute. Those are the areas they kind of need to look at first, and because they're going to be the hardest. Mm-hmm. And they're also the ones that are less likely to have in place today.
Thomas Jones of Bay Dynamics, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And finally, everyone agrees that cyber weapons are a growing part of military arsenals around the world, from those in the U.S., Russia, and China, to North Korea and Iran. But efforts to restrict the trade in cyber weapons risk outlawing a huge swath of legitimate security testing tools. An updated version of that treaty, known as the Wassenaar Agreement, was just approved by 42 nations who are signatories to it, and it includes good news for vulnerability researchers and information security firms. In this week's episode, Katie Masuris of the firm Luta Security came back into the studio to talk about the updated agreement, which she helped negotiate. I started by asking Katie to explain the new language regarding vulnerability research in the Wassenaar Agreement.
I'm Katie Masuris, founder and CEO of Luta Security. So good news is that essentially clarification language was added such that the export controls should no longer impede vulnerability disclosure or cyber incident handling. So that's some good news.
Talk a little bit just about kind of what you think the implications of that are or how that's going to play out.
The idea behind the Wassenaar arrangement is they agree at the nation level, and up until this week, there were 41 countries. Now there are 42. India was just added as a member country to the Wassenaar arrangement. So that's a big deal. So these 41 countries all get together and agree, and what they do is they bring back the agreement and update their national implementation of their export control rules. So they've agreed to it sort of at the architecture level, if you want to think of it that way, and then they've got to go back and write it into their export control code. So the United States was the only country that had not locally implemented it yet. You know, we took a deep breath pause as the industry outcry, you know, kind of caught up with what was going on, and we paused in our implementation. And so what comes next will be essentially all the countries will go back and consider, you know, how to implement it domestically. The United States, not having implemented it in the first place, has a couple choices going forward. So one, they might go back and renegotiate for additional clarifications. So the ones that came out are really, really good. There's room for improvement always, you know, as with everything. And so they may go back and renegotiate for some additional changes, or they may draft an implementation to allow for public comment, most likely. So, you know, that's all up to the different agencies in the United States government and figuring out what makes the most sense going forward, whether, you know, go back for more or draft, you know, a proposed export control rule domestically. But that is literally what we can expect going forward as a result of this. And so, you know, nothing has been implemented yet until that rule is, you know, that rule is approved. And, you know, it's kind of up in the air. There's a couple options on the table of go back and renegotiate for more or go ahead and draft an export control rule domestically.
Has there been a change or perceptible change that you've seen with the advent of the Trump administration?
So what the big question mark moment around the administration change and their position was actually like back in January of this year. And Ian Mulholland from VMware and I were the two, you know, we were the two industry experts that were asked by the State Department to join the delegation. And after December 2016's vote went in and we didn't get as many changes approved as we'd wanted to, you know, there were a lot of news articles that came out basically, you know, not understanding the timelines of the process, saying like, oh, the U.S. fails to renegotiate. So Ian and I actually wrote an opinion piece back in January explaining what, you know, essentially what we hoped would continue with the new administration, which is the continuing of that effort to finish, you know, essentially what we went there to do, which was to clarify these export control rules. And so we wrote that back in January. We were concerned. We didn't know. So many questions around the transition. And eventually we did, you know, get our marching orders to stay the course and continue that renegotiation. So the administration question mark basically was answered back in, you know, January, February timeframe of 2017, this year.
What's going to be the next milepost? What should we be looking for in terms of, you know, kind of further development on this story? And
well, yeah, like I said, I mean, I know that, you know, all 41 countries who participated in this are, you know, they're pretty happy, actually, pretty excited, you know, that we came to this agreement together. It does have to be unanimous for it to pass, you know, and everything. So I think that everybody is just going to take a little victory lap. I am eagerly awaiting, you know, what comes next from what the U.S. chooses to do as much as anybody else. You know, like I said, I laid out the options. The options are go back for a little bit more or try and implement, you know, the export control rule domestically and ideally offer it up for public comment again so that there's an opportunity for everyone to weigh in. I don't know. I mean, for me, the biggest part of this was, you know, being open to the influence of the policymakers and regulators, I think was key in Ian and I being effective in our roles, because we not only had, you know, kind of the technical practitioner backdrop, and we could give concrete examples of how the original language was unintentionally broad and unintentionally harmful. But we were able to empathize with the mission of these, you know, export control authorities, and the Wassenaar arrangement itself, you know, has held for over 20 years, you know, at this point as basically a tool for non-proliferation. So I think that was, you know, that I think going forward, the technical community should look at this as, hey, you know what? We spoke up as a community. We sent a couple of representatives of our community and we worked it out. We worked something out, you know, and I think that is something to celebrate. You know, I'm certainly going to be raising a glass to it later tonight. And I think everyone should, you know.
Katie Masuris, founder of Luta Security, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and speak with us at the Security Ledger podcast.
Yeah, good time. Thank you for having me.